There might be some school teachers among us who can relate to the experience of Jesus in Luke chapter 12, because the parable of the study that we're looking at this morning comes as a result of an interruption. It comes as a result of someone shouting out something that they were concerned with that really had nothing to do with what Jesus was teaching. Luke tells us at the beginning of chapter 12 that Jesus was not speaking to a trickle of curious visitors, but Luke says that many thousands had assembled to hear from Jesus. And this is amazing to me in an ancient context where there would not have been a large stadium with microphones and amplification systems. But Jesus presumably was somewhere in a city or in a large open context where he would have been speaking, as Luke says, to many thousands of people. And he's teaching on very important subjects. He's warning of the dangers of religious hypocrisy. He's assuring people of God's faithfulness and ongoing care. Jesus is inviting those listening to align themselves with him, to follow him. Well, there must have been a moment or two where nothing was being said or taught. Or perhaps the member of the crowd just shouted out what was on his mind. So someone shouts out, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." What an unusual statement to make. Again, the man's interest has nothing to do with what Jesus was teaching about. What's going on here? Well, it's likely that the man took Jesus to be a rabbi. And in those days, rabbis were expected to make judgments on disputed points of the law. But notice that Jesus wants nothing to do with this dispute. Jesus' response to the man, beginning with the address, "Man," is neither cordial nor is it diplomatic. Furthermore, we detect in Jesus' response a concern for the attitude that lies behind the request. Jesus says, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. For a man's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." First, let me say that I don't take Jesus to be saying that money or possessions are inherently bad. I think it's important to note that Jesus is not coming down on rich people here. The argument could be made biblically that money is necessary, and money has the capacity to be exceedingly helpful to us. But there appears also to be a wrong way to think about money. There is a wrong way to think about money. And so Jesus warns us this morning about greed. He warns us this morning about unduly thirsting for the acquisition of things. Jesus also makes an important statement about the purpose of our life. He says, "A man's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." From this, we can infer that our life does consist of something. It does consist of something, but it's not our money or our possessions. More than a decade or two ago, I shouldn't speak for the context here in the Bahamas, but in Canada, a decade or two ago, it was a common thing to see people with bumper stickers on their cars. I'm grateful that that's not the norm anymore. What a way to, you know, diminish the value or the attractiveness of a car is to put a bumper sticker on it. But one that I recall seeing from time to time read this: "The one with the most toys wins. The one with the most toys wins." And forgive me if you ever put that bumper sticker on your car, because I'm here to point out that what Jesus says here refutes that. What Jesus says here explicitly refutes that way of thinking. Money and possessions are not the be-all and the end-all. But money is, however, quite significant. Money is very important, and here's why. We exchange money for things we value. We exchange money for things we value. So what you do with your money, what you exchange your money for, says something about the priorities in your life. For example, we value things which nourish our bodies and things that taste good, and so every day, or at least every week, we exchange our money for food. Well, the other day I was in Phil's Food Service, and for those who aren't familiar with Phil's, it's on Gladstone Road, and it's one of my favorite places to go shopping, and I do so in an unsupervised way, which I do not recommend to my fellow husbands out there, because any rate, I'm off track. But I was at Phil's Food Service the other day, and I eagerly, willingly exchanged a lot of money for 12 enormous steaks. I mean, these were 14 ounces. I went to the counter, I said, no less than 14 ounces per steak, and I need 12 of them. And I said, that's going to cost. That's okay. I don't care what it costs. Whatever it takes, I need these 12 steaks. Now, at the end of my time at Phil's Food Service, you might have looked over my bill, and you would have immediately seen where my priorities lie. Because I was looking for bargains when it came for breakfast. $2 cereal, perfect. Because I don't care about breakfast. And you could see that by how little I spent on breakfast food. But I take my intake of proteins very seriously. And so I was willing and happy to give over much larger amounts of money. So you see the pattern developing. Money and what we exchange it for reveals our priorities. The amount of money we spend on entertainment and technology says something about how much you value it. And again, I'm probably not a good example of what a person should do. I mean, I've got a Galaxy S3, I've got an iPad, I've got a MacBook, I've got hundreds of iTunes songs, I've got an NHL subscription. I mean, clearly I've got my priorities in an area of little significance. So this is a bit of my confession. But I give my confession because I know there are others who invest their money very heavily in traveling. I know there are those who, without thinking twice, will spend money on extravagant cruises and vacations at high-end resorts. Why? Because you value that. So you exchange your money. Others will exchange large amounts of money for a membership at a particular sports club or at a particular social club. Still others will exchange large amounts of money to have a certain kind of car or a certain size boat. We also value the ministries of the church and local charities, and so we give our money to the church and we exchange money to charities, trusting they will do a good work. So the simple and obvious principle is that you exchange money for what you value. You exchange money for what you treasure. So your money is connected to your treasure. And your treasure is connected to what? Well, if we kept reading in Luke chapter 12, we'd hear Jesus say, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Where your treasure is, your heart will be also. So you can see this is no peripheral matter. This is not a matter of secondary importance. What we do with our money, what you exchange your money for, says something important about the state of your heart. So when a man from the crowd asked Jesus to help him get his share of the inheritance, it revealed something about the man's heart. It revealed something about the man's heart that caused Jesus to issue a warning about unhealthy attitudes toward money. And after warning about greed and warning about organizing one's life around possessions, Jesus tells a story. He tells a parable. And in the parable, a certain businessman is quite successful. And as a result of his success, finds that he needs to build additional barns for his crops. The man plans to accumulate such abundance that he will someday be able to take life easy, to eat and drink and be merry. But in the parable, God says to the man, "You fool! This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?" I want us to be clear, and I want us to accurately identify the error of the man in this parable. It's not a bad thing to produce a good crop. It's not a bad thing when your business prospers. It's not a bad thing when you get a promotion and a pay raise. It's not a bad thing when your investments increase in value. The man is not called a fool because he is successful. Our world needs successful farmers and profitable businesses. Why then is he called a fool? Well, the way Jesus tells this parable, it's evident that this man's diligence in business was not accompanied by any kind of diligence in the things of God. So the man's diligence in business was not accompanied by any amount of diligence in the things of God. Have a look at the passage and notice how many times we see personal pronouns used by the man. The parable is saturated with the words "I" and "my." The man's primary concern is obvious. My crops, my barns, my grain, my goods. As you can see, the man's foolishness is not a consequence of his wealth. The man's foolishness is a consequence of his attitude toward wealth. Jesus says that the man accumulated treasures for himself. He didn't accumulate treasures to serve God. He didn't accumulate treasures to ease the burdens of others. He accumulated treasures for himself. What made the man a fool was his blindness towards the temporary value of his money and his possessions. The man's diligence was entirely toward that which was of temporary value, while at the same time he neglected the thing that would have benefited him for eternity. While the man in the parable could seemingly control his investments, he had no control over his lifespan. And so Jesus calls the man a fool and warns those who would similarly store up things without being rich toward God. So we've talked this morning about a wrong attitude towards money. There's a wrong way to think about money. That's the negative side. Don't do this. Don't store up things. Don't act like they're forever when they're not. Don't organize your life about it. There's a lot of don'ts. But there's a positive. Jesus wants us to be rich toward God. Well, what does that mean? Pastor and author John Piper answers in a way that I think is very helpful. He says, "Rich toward God means counting God greater riches than anything on earth." Or we could put it another way. To be rich toward God is to regard God as your primary treasure. To be rich toward God is to regard Him as your primary treasure. So what does that look like? How do I get to that point where I set my life on a course where God becomes a greater priority, the greatest priority in my life? I think the Apostle Paul helps us in his letter, his first letter to Timothy. If we looked at 1 Timothy 6, verse 6, Paul tells us, "Godliness with contentment is great gain. Godliness with contentment is great gain. So the Greek word translated as gain, porismos, literally means money getting or profit. Paul is saying if you want to make a profit, if you want to be truly rich, then what you need is godliness with contentment. Now, I realize a cynic might say, well, Bryn, that sounds nice, but come on. Godliness is not going to pay my bills. Godliness, the mortgage company is not interested in my personal level of morality. Godliness is not going to pay my bills. Godliness is not going to help me upgrade my boat. Godliness is not going to pay for my next vacation. I wonder if Paul anticipated that kind of perspective, because I think he did. I think Paul anticipated that kind of response, because the very next statement he makes to Timothy is this: we brought nothing into this world, and we will take nothing out of this world. We brought nothing into this world, and we will take nothing out of it. Paul's reminding us that our earthly belongings have an expiry date, that they're not forever. You cannot take your home or your property to heaven with you. You cannot take your new car or your boat to heaven with you. You cannot take your jewelry or your art collection to heaven with you. But you can take your godliness to heaven with you. You can take your contentment to heaven with you. There are things that we can pursue in this life that will last forever. Godliness with contentment profit us for eternity. But they also help us today, don't they? It helps us today. Because, dear friends, don't you want to be happy right now? I mean, you take some consolation, I trust, in the delayed gratification and the promises of heaven. You know that someday everything will be made right. Every injustice will be corrected. Every sorrow will be turned to joy. All death will be destroyed. We know that someday we'll be happy in heaven. But what about now? Do you desire to be completely satisfied with your life today? Of course you do. Of course you do. So pursue godliness. Pursue Christ-likeness, and you will find that your level of contentment with life will soar. The principle isn't all that different than what we learned last Sunday. Last Sunday, we read about Martha, who was busy in the kitchen. She was very productive getting things done. But her attitude and her focus were on the wrong things. Mary, on the other hand, sat nearby and listened to Jesus. And Jesus said that Mary, and not Martha, chose what was best. By every appearance, Jesus would rather have our company than our activity. Jesus would rather have us pursue and prefer heavenly gain than things that would only help us and be advantage to us in this life only. Again, the Bible's not saying it's wrong to be productive. The Bible's not saying it's wrong to be successful or wealthy. Christianity does not require you to extinguish your desire for every worldly thing. But being a Christian does require that we actively kindle a desire for the best thing. Christianity does require that you actively kindle a desire for the best thing. And when we pursue the best thing, which is Jesus Christ, we are told that the payout, that the dividends, that the profit of pursuing Jesus Christ is godliness with contentment. Friends, I am certain that you have seen what I have seen, and that is that many individuals that we walk with and know very well, we know many individuals who lack contentment. Maybe as you sit here this morning, it's possible you're thinking, Britton, that's me. I'm not a very content person. I don't know that that's the case. You alone would know how you're feeling. But what we do know for certain is that discontentment is a common thing in our day. It's a common thing that we see in people even very close to us. And the common response to discontentment, the common response to this aching feeling that we're missing something, is we try to fill that hole, or we try to fill that void, and we usually try to fill it with one of three things. We try to fill it with things. We try to accumulate money and possessions and properties, and we imagine that if we have enough of these things, then we will be content. There are others who are looking for experiences. These individuals know that life is more than what you have, but sometimes it's the sum of what you've experienced. And so some people looking for contentment are off experimenting and trying all kinds of things, hoping that some cocktail of experiences will bring them contentment. And there are others who are looking to fill that void, looking to fill that hole with a human relationship. And it could be any kind of human relationship. It could be a person searching for a husband or a wife. Or maybe you're in a marriage and you're expecting your spouse to fill that hole within you. Or maybe you're expecting that from your children. Or from your grandchildren. Or from your best friend. Many people imagine that there's a human relationship or a few human relationships that will fill the hole or fill the void. But in spite of our best efforts to fill the void with such things, in spite of our sincere efforts to overcome this chronic discontentment, it remains. It remains. Why is that? Why are we so unsuccessful at filling the hole in our heart with things, with experiences, and with people? It's because you are made for something much bigger. You are made for something much bigger. You are made by God. But you are made for God. See, God didn't simply make you so that you could enjoy all those things as the first thing. He made you so that you could enjoy Him as the first thing and all of those other things as secondary matters. I love the way Augustine puts it. Augustine said, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." I don't know about you, but I could summarize my conversion to Christianity in that statement by Augustine. That my heart was restless. And it remained restless until I found my rest in Christ. And we gain true contentment from that because that's the design. That it's a God-shaped void that no earthly thing or person can fill. The fool in the parable thought he could bring contentment with his money and with his possessions. And many people today are doing the same thing. And as a result, you're seeing a lot of disappointment and a lot of despair in people's lives. I guess what I really want to say this morning is this. The Bible offers a wonderful alternative. The Bible offers a better alternative. Godliness with contentment are the byproducts of going after Jesus Christ. That what we really want in life, to be satisfied, to be happy, to be content, that the greatest thing we're really looking for is a byproduct of living in communion with Jesus Christ. And I want you to know that Jesus is not hiding from you. He has not left the phone off the hook, as it were. Rather, Jesus is calling you. Jesus is calling you, perhaps even today. And he's saying, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Dear friend, what I want you to know is that if you answer the call of Jesus, you will have everything you really need. Amen.